The following is a production of Art Trap Productions, brought to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you. This episode brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. This episode also brought to you by Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. Check out their website at dlair.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. This is Louis Trapani, and joining me here is Anthony S. Burge, and this show is dedicated to the memory of Alexei Kondratiev. So we are here, we're just about to play our live show that we recorded a couple of weeks ago at Fiddlesticks in New York City, which was a launch event for the book The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who, which Anthony is one of the contributors and authors of. In the audience, Alexei was there in the audience, and we called out to him, and he met us as well as other people there, and unfortunately, I guess it was a week or so after the show, he suffered a heart attack, and we lost him.
Yeah, he passed away of heart failure and trouble on his way home. He was a professor and teacher at a Celtic Institute, the Irish Arts Center, and he was on his way home and passed on his way home. He was at the May 20th Doctor Who event and thank you very much, guys, for coming and doing the live show. Ken, I know James was, it was too late for James, but thank you to him anyway, especially you, Lou, as well, for putting it all together.
Thank you for having us. And
yeah, of course. It's not a Doctor Who event with Doctor Who Podshock or Doctor Who New York, either one of you guys.
And I just want to, before you go on, just make a note that we are recording this in the evening, and that's why James, because of the time difference in the UK, James is unable to be here right now. And Ken is working, but he does want to send his regards, saying that it was an honor to have met him.
And I appreciate that, Ken. I'm very grateful for that. It was great that you guys had a chance to meet. Because, and I'll read a little something from Jesse and I, not so formally, but that was the last time we saw him. A week later, May 28th, shortly thereafter, he passed. It was the last time Jesse and I saw him. I have a great image, as he was always do at Mythopoeic Society events and other events that we had, you know, mainly primarily Mythopoeic Society events, MythCon and stuff, that he would be sort of in the background, an observer, but he was passionate not only for his own scholarly and literary and linguistic and storytelling passions, you know, passion for his own passion, I guess, but passionate for the community's endeavors, passionate for his friends' successes, I guess. That was one of the reasons he showed up, was to support our work. You know, I have a wonderful image of him smiling in the background, and there's a picture on my Facebook profile of him that was taken by Taras, and I'm very grateful to Taras of that, of him sitting there next to Jesse and us having a chit-chat.
If you're listening to this in the Enhanced podcast, we're going to include some of those images in that. So,
well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yes. So, yeah, it's, you know, we've been doing the show, you know, Doctor Who Podshock for 5 years, and obviously the Gallifreyan Embassy has been around for 25, and we've, for the most part, we're fortunate that we haven't lost too many, but I know we already lost, you know, people that were involved in the, you know, in the club, and, you know, and I'm sure probably, you know, I can't attest to, you know, all our listeners, but it's just the fate of the numbers and all that, that we probably lost some listeners along the way over the years as well, but it's difficult to imagine, you know, and especially this happening so quickly right after our live show. We had just met him and he was just there, and it's just a shame, you know. Well, I'm glad that he was there for the live show.
Yeah, I'm very glad he was, and he had every intention of listening to the live show. I know, because,
well, he was there in person, so he got to listen to it.
He was there in person, and he knew of podcasts and stuff like that, but he was more of a Burke book literary, you know, old school person in that direction. But I told him he got a card. I gave a Dr. Podshock card, and I told him about the podcast and what was going to be happening that evening. He stayed through the whole thing to see it unfold. I don't think, I'm sure he'll hear it in his own way, but, you know, he had every intent of checking out Doctor Who Podshock, the live show, and every other one that I told him about.
Mm-hmm. again, our condolences to you, Anthony, and Jesse, and everyone else that you know he has touched along the way. And you know, we're honored to have met him, and we're honored to have him, you know, albeit maybe a small part of the show, a part of our live show.
Well, thank you very much. It just, if you don't mind, I'll tell you a little bit what I had here. But the important thing I think to remember for anybody who wants to know more about him, you can Google his name, and you'll see the dozens of communities that he touched. And the reason I bring that up is just that I will link that to what Ken said in a past episode of Doctor Who Podshock about the importance of community. Our book was a book written by fans for fans, but it was primarily, you know, a community effort. People from the community helped put it together. Jesse and I were not, and Christine were not the only people that contributed not only to the writing of the book, but, you know, fact-checking and all of that stuff. So it was a community effort. And he was not a person who would self-promote himself. If you got into a discussion about things that you were passionate about, you know, he would want to hear as much about yours as, you know, he would tell you about his. But he was very humble, and that to the dozens of communities, literally dozens, this is a man who the Irish Vice Council came to his funeral because he did such a contribution to the Celtic Irish arts and culture. Mm-hmm. And that he provided guidance and education. Storytelling to him was very important. So as we know in Doctor Who and the community, the stories and the telling of those stories and the writing of those stories is important to us. So he would critique them as, you know, as Doctor Who fans, we critique the stories of Doctor Who, and language was important to him. And without, he would do this all without boundaries. Nothing was a boundary to him, whether it was, you know, racial, cultural, nothing, there was no boundaries. And it was more important to him to support the endeavors of his fellow human being, despite not being a television owner. He wasn't much for television, but he knew of Doctor Who. But it wasn't just the fact that it was a Doctor Who book. It was the fact that it was something he's passionate about, mythology, and supporting those who have equal, if not, it didn't matter what, you know, if you have the same passions, he was there to support us and everybody else. He was actually heard from someone that he was actually very happy for us that this had taken place. I just like to share that he was an inspiration to a lot of inspiring students, and I can go into detail about how it inspired Jesse and I. But just to share with community here, the Mythopoeic Society agrees that he inspired people, so that they now have plans to name the new award for best student paper presented at a MythCon, the Alexei Kondratiev Student Paper Award. And they hope this worldwide who attend MythCon will aspire to the heights in which he achieved for himself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry if I just wanted to share some of that, because we in the Doctor Who community, like Ken said, and you guys spoke of the importance of community. So it's the importance of our community and Doctor Who, but it's also coming out to support each other and educate each other, to share with each other, because unfortunately we don't know how long we're here to do
that.
None
of us do, yeah. It's you know, life may not be long, but it's wide, you know, if we make it wide. So to, as you said, community and being inclusive of that, and, you know, being involved.
Yeah, and that's what he was about to us and to the many people. I don't want to go into more of the mourning or sadder aspects, but literally the funeral director said that they should have had a bigger room at the wake services because so many people came to the evening services.
Mm.
That was just, and we met people that were, I lost count of how many people were representing of different communities that he affected and touched. He made an outsized contribution to every community he touched. So that is the bottom line to me, and the lesson we should learn, if we to learn anything, is reach out to your fellow human being and support their endeavors, regardless of whether you're passionate about it. Support each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can agree that we have that in the Doctor Who community here in New York. But if you're into other things, then equally support those things as well.
Sure. Well, and to his memory, we dedicate this show of Doctor Who Podshock to his memory. So without any further ado, let's go on with our live show recorded at Fiddlesticks in New York City. And once again, thank you, Anthony, for allowing us to be there and record live.
Not a problem. Thank you again, once again, for supporting our book.
And now, Doctor Who Podshock, episode 207.
Live from Fiddlesticks in Manhattan in New York City, this is Doctor Who Podshock. Doctor Who Podshock.
Okay, well, let's do it.
No.
You know, whatever it is, if it's valuable, send it to us.
For the best in all things Doctor Who, it's Doctor Who Podshock, the podcast all about Doctor Who, the longest-running science fiction television program, with Lewis Trapani.
Hello.
Ken Deep.
Hello.
James Norton.
Hello.
News.
Fabulous.
Reviews.
Oh, no.
And fan mail for James.
Over 40,000.
Doctor Who Podshock, from the Gallifreyan Embassy.
You know, that guy James was really cool. Oh, yeah, we blew that.
I'm the Doctor, and who are you? And who are you?
Live in front of a...
live audience.
Yes, in front of a live audience.
Imagine that.
My name is Ken Deep. Alongside me, for real this time, is Mr. Lewis Trapani.
Hello, everyone.
And it's presented by the Gallifreyan Embassy in its 25th year. Only just under a month from today, we'll be celebrating our 25th anniversary.
25 years.
Thank you very much. Originally known as the Gallifreyan Embassy of Long Island.
Yes.
Now the Gallifreyan Embassy of Earth. All right.
World domination.
We are here recording live at Fiddlesticks for one reason and one reason only, and that is to celebrate the release of The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who. It is a
book.
It's a book. Thank you, Lewis. It's not to be confused with The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who DVD.
That's coming soon.
It is a wonderful book. It is reasonably priced and available at all good booksellers worldwide.
All fine bookstores.
It is a collection of essays about the connection between Doctor Who and mythology. Doctor Who, like all great storytelling, has a theme and connects issues and ideas relevant to this generation and others. There are common themes throughout history in literature and in storytelling. Doctor Who is no different. And the reason it survived for nearly 50 years at this point is because there's something universal about its storytelling. Good versus evil, a morality play. Mm-hmm. And for probably the number one reason, and the thing that people most often gloss over, is that it's just plain old fun.
Yes, it's an adventure through time and space.
More so than any other show, any other series of books, mm-hmm. audios, movies, television, it has the ability to go anywhere at any time, any place.
Yes, the format leads open to anything.
The format is infinite. You guys are all here to celebrate the book release. And so rather than us going on about this, let's talk to some of the people involved in the book.
Yeah, it would be really cool if they were here.
Probably the man who spearheaded this project is Anthony.
Spearhead from space, Mr.
Come on
Anthony
up.
S. Burge.
Anthony Burge. Please come sit and
welcome
tell us
to,
about...
once again, welcome back to Doctor Who Podshock.
For those not seeing photographs, it's a very strange situation we have here. It's a sort of altar-ish looking thing.
We're on our throne.
And instead of people coming and sitting next to us or across from us, they're actually sitting at our feet.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Well,
I do.
It's our first time for everything, so... So we welcome Anthony back to Doctor Who Podshock. You may remember Anthony. How could you forget him? He did our lovely reports from the East Village Cinema just a month ago here on Doctor Who Podshock 192 and 193.
He remembers those numbers.
Yes, they're lucky numbers. Anthony was on them.
Yeah, fantastic bit of reporting from the Village Cinema.
I especially like the ferry cast. We did a car cast, yes. And you did a ferry cast.
Yes, I did a ferry cast. At the same time, you were doing a car cast.
No, it was fantastic to see almost instantaneous reporting via Twitter and all the other social mediums.
Yeah, you got to see Dana. I was going to say Amy Pond, but all the people lined up on the Village Cinema.
Well,
you did
well.
See Dan. Amy Pond.
Yes, we did see Amy Pond.
We saw the real and
you saw
we
the
saw
real
the Dana.
Amy.
Yeah, and the cosplayer. And Blake Kim here, who's actually ahead of me. I was the fifth in line, and Blake was the fourth.
Fantastic.
Jody, who's not here tonight, who was at the Borders event, which, by the way, just to give you a little... Sherry was the one who organized the Borders event.
Oh, cheers. Hello.
Woohoo.
And apparently you had a very positive reception. This was an...
He says so, so I'll go with that.
All right, fantastic. They are doing... You guys are doing four events. This is the second of four?
This is the second. Sherry's was first. We had to give our home borough of Staten Island its, you know,
its due.
It's proper due.
It's proper due. So we have two events on Staten Island. The first was Borders. Second is here at Fiddlesticks with you guys. Third is the New York Public Library Tottenville branch, which is about four blocks from our house. And then the final event will be with David Howe and Sam Stone on the 27th.
At well, actually, Forbidden Planet.
Well, the final New York City event for the moment at Forbidden Planet because we have a London launch May 26th, the day before the Forbidden Planet, which is going to be the British Science Fiction Association has put it together. One of our contributors, Colin Harvey, and Tony Keene over there. It's at 7, I think. I don't know. I have to check Facebook and all that.
That's Wednesday? Wednesday, May 26th?
Yeah, it's at London.
We're going to send a reporter to that.
I'm hosting James. Yeah, that's cool. I appreciate it.
All right. But, you're definitely going to send somebody there.
Yeah.
You hear that, James?
But
we're counting
now,
on
you. I just found out tonight, you did an event at Borders.
Yeah.
In Staten Island, I heard that you've been invited back, that it was such a rousing success.
She's saying a positive yes, yep.
That's in December 2010.
2010, yeah.
Watch this space for updates. So cool. For those of you hearing this podcast, perhaps you've discovered PodShock later on or you're a little backlogged on it. You still have a chance to celebrate
the mythological
dimensions.
Oh, come on. You've got to be a supporting subscriber and be up to date.
Exactly.
Why not?
Exactly.
I am.
Okay, let's start at the beginning, shall we?
First, the Earth cooled. And then the dinosaurs came.
Well, talk to the astrophysicist about that.
Let's start at the beginning. Where do you come up with an idea for putting a book together?
Well, that I will have to actually give the mic over to my lovely wife, Jessica, and my co-editor, Christine Larson, because though I spearheaded and put the manuscript together, and a lot of people helped me do that, it was their argument watching Stolen Earth and Journey's End because, okay, just a little back history. I chaired a conference called MythCon, which the MythPeak Society has been around for, Alexei, what is it, almost 40 years now?
40 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
The MythPeak Society, they're dedicated to the study of mythology, but primarily right now, you know, the Tolkien, the Inklings, C.S. Lewis and stuff. But they do look at lots of other mythological ideas and stuff like that. So each year they hold a conference in a different location. So that 2007, was it? 2008. It was at Christine's college, where she's a professor at, which was Central Connecticut State University, which she can tell you about. And I chaired the event. Christine was a site liaison. We all presented papers and stuff. Jesse did overall programming. Alexei back there was the papers coordinator. And leading up to what they'll tell you is after the conference was over, we were at Christine's house, and the internet fairy delivered Stolen Earth and the Journey's End. And,
those internet fairies.
Yes, and exactly. Christine hadn't seen the final episodes of that season yet. So I got them. We sat back with a bunch of drinks, and from that point, yeah, I'll let them discuss.
Come on,
how
we're gonna make this very round robin. Come up, sit.
Let's
sit
here to Jessica Burr.
Hello.
Yes, please. We have a large group of writers. I know. Scoot down, she says. Oh, this is gonna be. This is like Unplugged.
And we also have one of the contributors, Melody Green, there. As well.
Hello. Come on up,
Miss Melody Green.
And actually, we'll just pull in a chair or slide over, and we have a very
limited amount of microphones.
There's room on the throne if you want to get up here.
Sit on Anthony's lap.
Oh my. So what we have now is, this is a collection of essays about mythology. So that's the reason why when you say, oh, suddenly there are four writers on stage,
right,
on throne with us, it is mostly because that this isn't one particular author. This is a series of essays with a common theme about mythology and Doctor Who.
Correct. This is Jessica. Just am I speaking?
Yes, please introduce yourself across the line here.
I'm Jesse.
I'm Chris.
I'm Melody.
Welcome you all to Doctor Who Podshock.
Thank you. Oh, Lewis the King.
I'm not being antisocial by not joining you, but there's no room down there.
The Podfather. Father.
He deserves the throne.
Well, then you don't have a seat, so.
Basically, as Anthony was talking about, at the conference, am I talking into it? Is it
get
okay?
In close, get
okay,
in close.
Good, yes?
There you
yay.
Go.
At the conference, there's a lot of discussion after we were catching up, Christine, on the end of that season of Doctor Who. The Internet Fairy visited and the Wine Fairy visited as well. And actually, the thrust of the conference was, with the Mythopoeia conference, every year there's a different theme. And that particular year, it was a theme that I chose. It was Valkyries. And that theme was inspired by an academic, Leslie Donovan, who's a medievalist out of New Mexico State. And she wrote an article called The Valkyrie Reflex in Lord of the Rings, where she basically broke down what the Valkyrie was according to about 14 points. So being academics and geeks at heart, Chris and I got into a very heated, alcohol-induced discussion about who was a Valkyrie, Donna or Rose. And you want to elaborate?
And we all know it's Rose, but I won't go there. But it was one of those brilliant moments where you really understand the power of Doctor Who, and you understand how it transcends all boundaries of classification. It's not just brilliant television, it's brilliant mythology, it's brilliant scholarship. And the fact that Jesse and I, in our wine-induced haze, could have a coherent conversation about who was a better Valkyrie speaks volumes about why the series has been around 6 months less than I've been alive. So, I'll just say that.
And also that we remembered our conversation, too.
Well, I think we're taking notes down feverishly.
No, we weren't.
Oh, you weren't?
We weren't.
Oh, God. You've got a better memory recall than I do.
But we had this discussion, and then Anthony had some ideas of his own for a different essay, because he said, well, why don't you guys write about this? Do an essay. And so he had some ideas, and then we're like, well, who's going to publish this? Where are we going to get it published? And he said, well, why don't we write our own book? And it kind of, it went from there. At first, we toyed with the idea, and then we put together a proposal and sent it to a friend, Anne Petty, who's a colleague in the Tolkien world. And it turned out that she was on the board of a publisher, Kitsune Books. And the remaining board members are all huge Doctor Who fans.
They had been watching the series as it aired, BBC America, you know, catching up and getting the stuff from the Internet Fairy and stuff like that. And we wrote how we know Anne Petty is us. We all walked the fine line of being involved in a Tolkien community, but also Doctor Who fans. Anne is a big author and novelist and academic and stuff. And we wrote the foreword to her book called Dragons of Fantasy.
Right.
And that had just come out. So that was sort of fresh in our minds. So they were the perfect choice.
Let me ask you about mythology, and in particular Tolkien, who you are all well-versed in, because this is really the primary focus of your publisher seems to be. They have a background in Tolkien.
Well, the publisher Kitsune Books haven't put out Tolkien books, but Anne Petty is very well versed. She has her, like Christine, has their feet in multidisciplinary, you know, work, you know, various communities. So Anne is a Tolkien scholar. She's a novelist. She's into anime. She's into all sorts of stuff. So, go ahead.
And I also think Kitsune, they're a small publisher, and they're kind of called an upstart because they're challenging a lot of the big boys. And they do academic publishing, but they do it more for mainstream, because often you'll get an academic publisher that kind of really tries to play to a more elite crowd by slapping a $60 or $70 or $100 price tag on their book. And they only have a small run, and they don't do things like this.
They wouldn't meet at a pub?
No. Oh, no. Although...
Well, the myth being society...
Any mythy knows that academics like to drink.
Right, Alexei? I'll tell you. Yeah.
And some of the best conversations come out over a pint or three.
Or four. Or ten.
But Kitsune is, I think they're challenging a lot of folks by by having this kind of a really accessible book. It's reasonably priced. It's only $15,
The thing about this book that I find fantastic is that there are themes between classic literature that you see in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, or the Lord of the Rings period, I should say, prior to it being divided up. So let me ask the authors a little bit on your personal take, each of you. What are the things that are more closely related between the two subject matters as opposed to the things that sets them apart? What are the things that binds those together beyond mythology? What is it that makes Doctor Who just as classic, just as relevant in the history of mythology as Tolkien?
Thinking, it's one of those things like Tolkien. It is its own universe. It's complete. With Tolkien, with Lord of the Rings, with Middle Earth, here's a single author who worked first from language, turning into creating his own mythology. Tolkien wanted to create a mythology for England. All the other countries had their own mythology. Doctor Who, I think, is unique. It's different, not just because of sci-fi and it's a different media, but it's different because it's a mythology that is not complete. It's always being added
always growing,
to. It's always being interpreted. And it's sort of to take a line from something that Tolkien said in his letters regarding Middle Earth, that it's there is space and room for many hands and minds and hearts to add to. And I'm butchering his
no, you had
quote.
It pretty much right.
I did?
You had it pretty much right.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, you had it pretty close.
You want Christine? Let Christine.
I think that part of the brilliance behind not only Doctor Who, but Tolkien and now Lost, is that it speaks to people in all disciplines. On the sake of disclosure, I actually have a PhD in astrophysics, and that's where I'm coming to this from. And I think that Doctor Who speaks to people who are into mythology and philosophy and ethics and science and literature and all of the great science fiction any of the great stories from time immemorial speak to everyone in their own personal way. And I think that is one of the brilliancies of Doctor Who, is that no matter how you come to it, no matter what discipline you come to it, you can make it your own and you can find something that you can really glom onto.
Well,
it's interesting because it's not pure science fiction.
No.
So if you're coming to it from the sciences, or you're coming to it from literature, or you're coming to it from almost any area, it's certainly not perfect. It's not the perfect example of any one of those things, and yet someone can come away with something that they feel valuable.
Just to bounce off of what Christine said, a little bit, you know, personal, from my personal story of Tolkien and Doctor Who growing up with it, first and foremost, my parents introduced Tolkien to me when I was in utero. My mother said reading The Hobbit to me while I was in utero. So to me, I grew up with that, but in the 80s started to get into Doctor Who, and as you guys have seen my Ring of Eldred, you know, had been subjected to it, you know, my first story was The Hand of Fear, and I do remember in the 80s, the Gallifreyan Embassy on WLIW.
Yeah, we remember them too.
Yeah, you do?
Yeah.
Who are those guys?
Goofy group,
and watching the fundraisers, and, you know, seeing Doctor Who on she brought it. She brought the hand.
You can't see it in the audio podcast,
I
you
do
can feel the power.
You can feel the power.
Feel the power.
Eldred must live. That Tolkien is multidisciplinary as well. It's not just people say he's father of modern fantasy. I think that's a little bit, you know, what's the term? You're not putting it right, because it is a created history, and there's so much to it, and that's so much effort that he put into it. That, and she brought the TARDIS key as well. Well, my wife came prepared. But that I see Tolkien's Middle Earth as an archaic mythology for England, which he dedicated to. Doctor Who is our modern mythology, in which the two, I do believe, not just a mythological sense, in which Tolkien crosses many genres. Okay, may not necessarily cross into science fiction, but I say there's linguists, there's history, there's a whole bunch of stuff. And you can trace a lot of the stuff that he was into and wrote about in the stories, and you can source it and find out more. And I think that's very much the case with Doctor Who, is which you can see a lot of the stuff, like my essay dealt with in the book, it dealt with how Doctor Who and Tolkien can cross over, in which we see at the Time Lords, in which the Master says, "Say hello, Gandalf." Now, what does that say? You know, what impact does that have? What weight does that carry? Hey, the gentleman's handing me a Guinness. That's awesome. Cheers, and thank you for coming. But I think that had a lot of weight for me. That held a lot of weight. The mythologies cross, and actually, it's not the first time that's happened. You know, people have wanted crossovers between Tolkien and Doctor Who for years. I showed you, which you didn't get a chance to read it, but you will one of these days. I'll send you a copy. Beyond Bree, Nancy Marsh, Christine would know of that, sent me a copy of one of their journals from the 80s, and a contributor wrote a crossover where the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane land in Middle-earth to the wedding of King Aragorn and Queen Arwen. So, you know, it's been going on longer, you know, crossovers of different mythologies for years. But I think the impact that they have for us as people is that they hit certain emotional levels. There are certain emotional cues, you know, intellectual cues, things that resonate with us as subjects individually, but also as a community. And that's what mythology, I think, is about, whether we accept it as part of a culture, cultural specific, or a particular religious specific. It doesn't matter. They're all subjective interpretations, and they have broadening, you know, perspectives. Why they're being waved at?
Yes,
I know. Go ahead. I'm blathering on. Go ahead.
You get the same question as well. What is the thing that draws them together? What makes them? What makes there be a common bond between these mythologies?
One of the things that I was looking at, and as I'm listening to each person talk, I'm going to say that I agree with everything everyone has said. And the work that I did, I was looking specifically at one particular theme. And so it's a theme that is in both Tolkien and Doctor Who. And I think that's one of the things that really connects the two, is the specific themes. Like mine was sacrificial death. Now, Tolkien in his letters said that the... if he had to say there was a theme to the Lord of the Rings, in one of his letters he says it's death. And that is something that comes up over and over and over again in Doctor Who as well. In both stories, both sets of mythologies, you've got characters who die to save other people for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. So. But never the Doctor. The Doctor winds up inspiring other people. And I've always been puzzled by that in the mythology, because you can, mm-hmm. you could make... We think of him as the hero, but one could go back to his original roots and say that he is the anti-hero, because he's never the one.
He's a very complex character that way. Other people die to save him. He inspires other people to die to save other people. But even when he himself chooses, as with in the case of Wilfred,
to save Wilfred by performing a sacrificial act, he just comes back as a different person, of course.
Yes.
But he cannot completely do this. That's a very good point.
One of the reasons for being an author and being a writer, whether you're published or not, in your case, you all are, sometimes is to learn something in your research, in preparing, in particular with a project like this, which is a nonfiction. Let me go across the line and find out, what did you learn going through this? You just spoke and you have the happy microphone. So what is it after researching this, and really you started with a point. You said, okay, I'm going to do this as my subject, my thesis. But what did you learn in the process?
One of the things that I learned, I would argue that Doctor Who is actually questioning certain aspects of this whole model we have in our culture about sacrifice. And I would argue that one thing I learned is that it's asking us, is this a valid way to look at things? That it's not just saying, oh, hey, this is a theme that happens over and over and over again in mythology. Let's simply repeat it. But it takes it a step farther. It challenges us to think more about it.
About why they would make that sacrifice.
Exactly.
I would say that one of the criticisms of Tolkien is that there are no strong women. And anyone who really delves into Tolkien knows that that's bullpucky. There are plenty of strong women. And starting from Leslie Donovan's brilliant paper about the Valkyrie, I think that feminists need to look at all of these science fiction shows and see all of the brilliant women characters who have been written in. Over the years, people have dismissed the companions of the Doctor as fluff. And that's simply not true when you look at it. I mean, no one can really call Sarah Jane fluff, for example. And so I think that hopefully people will begin to look at characters in other shows where women supposedly have been marginalized and think, have they really been marginalized, or are we just not realizing the power that they have within the mythos?
I'd have to agree with that, especially the first time I had made the attempt, and it was as an undergraduate, to do a really sort of I would say passionate, but a look at Tolkien beyond just a term paper. I had proposed it to an advisor that I was doing my undergraduate thesis with, and I said I wanted to do Tolkien, and she kind of, she wrinkled up her nose and said, Tolkien has no women in it. And at that point in time, I really, really admired this woman. She was a very strong feminist scholar, women's studies, the whole thing. But I had been reading Tolkien just about every year since I was 14. And I was 22 at the time. So I said, wait a minute. All right, she must know what she's talking about. So I didn't argue with her. And I went home and promptly read Tolkien again. I said, she's insane. So the next semester that I had her, I asked her. I said, what are you talking about? And she had never read it. She had never read anything by Tolkien, but was going by what someone else had said. And I find the same thing, what Chris just said, with Doctor Who and other science fiction, that because there is not a plethora of, let's say, Amazons running around with no men whatsoever, there are no strong women. I'm sure that, you know, there are a lot of feminists that are listening that will probably send me hate mail. But with the exception of maybe Dodo.
Aptly named.
Aptly named.
Always the exception, by the way.
And, you know, every companion has different things that make her strong and different things that make her annoying. Yeah. But there are still different types of strong female characters. I think that's something that I did find really interesting for me doing my essay. I'm not only a geek in terms of, you know, Tolkien and Doctor Who, but I'm like an Anglo-Saxon geek too. And I like writing academic work for people who would not normally read academic writing. I want to, and I do this in my classroom, trying to open up the field of academia. And especially what I've said before is what we did with this book, fans of Doctor Who are the first Doctor Who academics. You know, listening to any conversations and any you know, anything on a blog, a website or a forum or in a pub, all the discussions we have about episodes and different things, comparing doctors, it's all academic. But no one would really think of it as such. So I'm really pleased at the reception of the book, because a lot of people who are interested in it are not academics.
It's interesting that you say that, because we, as Doctor Who fans, amongst other science fiction, but in particular we're discussing Doctor Who, our discussions are never on the surfacey aspects of Doctor Who. There's always something deeper, richer going on in the discussion about what does this mean, why is this important, how is this significant to something else that's going on, whether it be in the story or as a reflection of something that's going on in real life.
And then, and also being able to link this, something that might have happened in the last episode, to something that happened 20 years ago.
Is academic.
You know, and it's a critical, analytical discussion that fans are often the first academics. But that also doesn't
mean... And their
writings. And it also doesn't mean that this is a lowbrow academic book either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it absolutely is not. And so for the academics out there that are saying, oh, it can't be genuine academia because it's about mainstream pop culture, I give you the invisible bird.
When someone decides they want to teach a class on Doctor Who, I hope I can get my 3 credits. When they use this book.
I think they do get
in the UK. There's an academic class in the UK.
I would hope so, and I would hope that someone considers
Cardiff, I believe.
For a textbook. Let's talk a second. You mentioned Dodo, so this is a great example. But only months before her appearance in Doctor Who.
Speaking of Dodo.
Yes. Is an appearance by Jean Marsh as Sarah Kingdom, who is this incredibly strong female character, someone who's in great command, who also sacrifices themselves for the Doctor, or for the cause that
Spoiler
the Doctor
alert.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that one. But here's an actress who brings incredible gravitas to that part for its time. And at that time, in 1966, 65, it's a children's show. It hadn't emerged since then. Yes, Anthony is the cause of that, by the way.
No touching.
This is why we can't have good things.
And Jean Marsh, only a year before that, playing King Richard the Lionheart's sister, also challenging a male character in 1965 television in the Crusades, was fantastic. She tells him, "I'm not going to be traded in a marriage. I'm not going to have an arranged marriage." And this is during the Crusades, and she's taking on. These are challenging topics for that year in television and that year in children's television. And I'm only stressing that because at that time, what was children's television like in the United States? It was Soupy Sales or something like that. It was
Captain
it was
Kangaroo.
Nothing even close to this. So
it was Captain Kangaroo.
Yeah, I find this incredibly fascinating. So I have to give it along to Anthony now. I'm on my right-hand side, who's also going to...
Right-hand side?
My right.
Your right? My left?
The right-hand side of God.
I think just to reflect back a little bit real quick what they were saying about what you asked them about the writing in Doctor Who and mythology. Doctor Who fans have been writing for years. You know, we have longtime fanzines like Shooty Dog Thing and Morbius and stuff. So it's not new to Doctor Who fans. That was just the first medium for them to connect with the community and share their own viewpoints on Doctor Who. And whether it was... a lot of the stuff that I've seen is not strictly reviews. It's actually not strictly, you know, dogmatic scholarly stuff, but it's, you know, their thoughts on and particulars and stuff. And then, we move along to, you know, the age of technology where we have podcasting and stuff. So it broadens that appeal. But I definitely think like Matt Hills, at the end of our book, he has a chapter called Mythology Makes You Feel Something. And I think that applies with what we were saying about Tolkien and Doctor Who, is that for mythology to appeal to you, it has to hit those mental centers, those personal centers, those emotional centers for you to really attach to it. And Tolkien's world did that for me in an archaic sense, because I'm a big fan of fantasy and history and, you know, just that type of old time, you know, I'm into Native American stuff. So it hits all of that for me. But when I like stuff in the modern day, and Doctor Who does that. You know, it's an ongoing story. But I definitely think it changed the format of children's programming, to bring it up to your current question, is when it appealed, and you mentioned Gene Marsh, which, we know Witchville is airing this Saturday.
Not with Gene Marsh, though.
No, not with Gene Marsh. It was the other one. That's Sarah Douglas, I'm sorry.
It's the
Gene 22nd Marsh was in Battlefield, right? Battlefield, right. And Battlefield, I think, and with Gene Marsh, was fantastic, because that really steps up the Doctor Who mythology in the sense that it connects it to classic myth of our world, and which is I think is a fantastic Seventh Doctor story, which I actually had the opportunity, when we met Sylvester McCoy this past week at Who York, to sell to him. There you go, Andre. To say to Sylvester McCoy, welcome. Are you here in our time of need now, Merlin? Which, if you know Battlefield, it connects the Doctor to supposedly being Merlin, in which I connect to him being Gandalf and using that bouncing off. But, what? She's signaling stuff, so I'm mixing it
she's
a little bit.
She's thinking with her hands.
Yeah, she's speaking with her hands. But I was connecting him back to his current question, which it changed, I think, the face of children's programming back then. Like, she can probably tell you better, because Doctor Who's only 6 months older than Christine. So
6 months younger than
younger.
I am.
I'm
yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you just dated a woman? I dated myself, so
yeah.
Sorry.
So we'll let Christine pull into that and talk about that.
I really think that we need to think about mythology and the seriousness of Doctor Who. And I have two words for people who don't understand the seriousness of Doctor Who. And the two words are Joseph Campbell.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that you really could deconstruct Doctor Who according to the hero's journey. And it's the writing...
The ultimate odyssey, I might
add. The ultimate odyssey, and yeah, through exactly. Time and space. And the writers, it's amazing how they've kept it up this long. I mean, there is no other medium, movie, television, or book series that has been able to keep up this number of stories consistently with this quality ever in the history
One
of
the
humankind.
Things that I've always found as an attraction to Doctor Who is that it is extremely organic. This isn't a construct of a giant movie studio. There isn't a marketing game plan behind it or anything like that.
Except for the sonic screwdriver.
It started very naturally in 1963, and it grew. This was all something that happened naturally and organically into this. I don't think that Anthony Colburn or Verity Lambert or Warris Hussein, any of those people at the very beginning said, we're off on a huge journey that's going to last half a century. I don't think that happened. You know, it started very, very naturally.
And naturally, we want to tie this episode of Doctor Who Podshock to a audiobook about Doctor Who and mythology. We're going to return to our live show at Fiddlesticks in just a moment. I just want to take a brief moment to thank our sponsor, Audible.com. It's the leading provider of digital audiobooks. They have over 75,000 titles to choose from in every genre, thrillers, business, history, science fiction, and more. Audible content is compatible with iPods, MP3 players, and over 500 devices for listening anytime, anywhere, just like you're doing right now with this podcast. And for you, the listeners of Doctor Who Podshock, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Now, speaking of Doctor Who and mythology, why not check out Doctor Who, The Mythmakers? Read by Stephen Thorne, written by David Cotton, It's an unabridged reading of a classic Doctor Who novelization first published by Target Books, I believe it was 1985, which is the 25th anniversary of the book, as well as the Gallifreyan Embassy. Long, long ago, on the great plains of Asia Minor, two mighty armies faced each other in mortal combat. The armies were the Greeks and the Trojans, and the prize they were fighting for was Helen, the most beautiful woman in the world. To the Greeks, it seemed the city of Troy was impregnable, and only a miracle could bring them success. And then help comes to them in a most unexpected way as a strange blue box materializes close to their camp, bringing with it the Doctor, Stephen, and Vicky, who soon find themselves caught up in the irreversible tide of history and legend. Let's hear a little bit from that now. This is a little bit different than what you had heard before. Now, other samples of Doctor Who audiobooks.
Look, over here, under the olive trees. That's right. By the pile of broken stones and the cracked statues of old gods. What do you see? Why, nothing but an old man sitting in the autumn sunshine and dreaming and remembering. That's what old men do, having nothing better to occupy their time. And since that is what I've become, that is why I do it. I heard your footsteps when you first entered the grove. So sit down, whoever you are, and have a slice of goat's cheese with me. There. It's rather good, you'll find. I eat very little else these days. My teeth gone, of course. You think it's sad to be old? Nonsense. It's a triumph. An unexpected one at that, because, I tell you, I never thought I'd make it past 30. Men do not frequently survive to senility in these dangerous times. But then, being blind, I suppose I can hardly be considered much of a threat to anyone. So somehow I've been allowed to live. Although probably more by negligence than by charity, or a proper concern for the elderly. And I'm grateful, for I have a tale or two still to tell, and a song or two to compose and throw to posterity, before I pass Acheron and meet my dead friends in the shadows of the netherworld. I am, you see, a myth-maker, and my name is Homer. I don't know if that will mean anything to you, but it is a name once well considered in poetic circles. No matter. No reputation lasts forever. But that is why I sit here in the stubble of the empty fields and lean against the rubble of the fallen city which once was Troy, while the scavengers flap in the ruins and the lizards run across my bare feet. At least I hope they're lizards. If they're scorpions, perhaps you'd be so kind. Ha, thank you. And I remember the beginning of it all. Long ago, when I was young. Listen.
Doctor Who, the Mythmakers. That could be your selection. Doesn't have to be. You can make your own selection. To download your free audiobook today, go to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap, ARTTRAP. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/arttrap for your free audiobook. Again, it doesn't have to be a Doctor Who book. It can be any audiobook that Audible.com is offering with this offer. So check them out, audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. And this sounds pretty interesting, this Doctor Who, the Mythmakers. We also like to thank for their support Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy, with stores in Austin and San Antonio, Texas, and now in Bellevue, Washington. They sell Doctor Who action figures, CDs, and comics. They also sell board games, role-playing games, card games, graphic novels, Magna, and a whole lot more. So check them out at dlair.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. They, too, are celebrating an anniversary coming up in August, their 24th anniversary, right on the heels of the Gallifreyan Embassy. So give them a hoot, or give them a who, or rather just give them a call 512-454-2399, or once again, go to their website at dlayer.net. That's D as in dragon, layer.net. Let's go back to our live recording at Fiddlesticks in New York City with the authors and contributors of The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who. And keep on listening for an opportunity to get your own copy that we're giving away. We're giving away two copies of this book to Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers.
Let's go to a personal side to all this, including us. Talk about a moment of Doctor Who that really connected with you in the using this mythology as our basis for the question. Give me that moment that you said, this was the connection right here. Perhaps a particular episode or a particular scene that pulled it together. I've offered a challenging question, and that's why the mic is being passed heartily. I know Anthony is ready to go because he's always has something ready to go.
I don't know. Am I? Do I really?
You know what? But while you guys are thinking about this, let me comment on this for 1 second and say that this, what we're doing here on the podcast and in front of a group of people who've gathered together, this is why we're Doctor Who fans. Mm. We're just doing it right now on a microphone and going out over a podcast. But it started with newsletters and discussion groups in 60-something, whenever the first group of Doctor Who fans, and here in the United States, Doctor Who fans in the late 70s, but also Star Trek fans and Tolkien fans and things like that, people would get together and discuss, and a community formed. Small, large, didn't matter. Discussions happened, minds opened, and positivity. Whether you agreed with someone or disagreed, you began to respect someone's opinion. You began to learn how to form your own, and hopefully, through discussions, and in reading this book, for me, I've only had the book 4 days. Well, okay, I had a PDF a little longer, but having the physical copy, you're hearing other people's opinions, other people's takes on their impressions and what it means to them, and hopefully you get something out of it that enriches your experience of Doctor Who, or anything. But we're talking specifically.
To that end, why don't I ask what was the process like writing the book? You have contributors both here in the U.S. and in the U.K. This was the first time I believe you guys did a collaborative writing project.
Can we illustrate the heart attacks?
Yeah.
So how did that all come together? Did you have
throw them off the first question.
Did you have conflicts within? Well, Ken, I couldn't get a question in edgewise here.
Did we have conflicts? Do you really want to know?
You were sitting up here. You moved.
Yeah, I know. Well, just real quick with what Ken was said. Mythology and Doctor Who, the key scene was the Horns of Nymon for me in the 80s with Nymon and you know, the Minotaur, and I grew up with classic stories of the Minotaur, so I started to realize, and as I started to watch older Doctor Who, you know, you get the Aztecs and the Trojan Horse and, you know, those stories as well, which are more tied into they're classic stories, but like the Aztecs comes from there's the Aztec culture in Mexico and stuff. So some of that is actual historical fact of the sacrifices and stuff. But that was just some of the key mythological scenes that, you know, resonate with me that popped up. To answer Lou's question, oh, that's a broad topic. how did the book come together?
Well, how was the process like? You have
It was bound up by the publisher.
Yeah, it was glued in his paper in there.
You have both contributors in the U.S. and the U.K.
Yeah,
and you communicated with each other. How did you avoid any? Were you worried about conflicts? Maybe one person was writing an essay that proved one point, and another person was writing an essay that might have contradicted that point.
No. What we were trying to do was that each essay had to be sort of streamlined. Everybody has their argument that for the topic, and the process began by putting a book together like this, is you put out a call for papers. And Christine, Jesse, and I, we formulated this call for papers, which is standard procedure for an academic book. Christine's very well got a plethora of books and publishing, and she can tell you all about that. But to my knowledge, if you're going to have a collection, you put out a call for papers, and we get abstracts by a certain date of the idea that these people want to have in that book. And we select from them what we want to have in the book, how we feel about those topics,
how they sound to us when they come to us. So we, okay, you're selected. Now have your papers to us by a certain date. And I think that was like July of 2009.
Did you have certain people in mind already when you started the project?
No, we didn't. It was, we knew we had our pieces that we were going to be put in the book. So Jesse, and of course, and Chris had their pieces. I had mine. So as the pieces came along, Melody Green, of course, had her piece, and obviously she's in the book. So we liked her idea. You know, but I'm not speaking down of that. I'm just saying we loved her idea. She fleshed it out really well, and there was, you know, through the whole process working with the contributors, you know, you help them refine sort of their argument or topic. We all review it, and the publisher reviews it.
Was there ever a time that you had any doubts about it? Did it become...
There was a big doubt last summer, which I'm now going to tell that story.
Okay.
Again?
Yes, again. And just real quick, is last summer I had... I took a flying leap off my bike and had a concussion. And there was a little bit of a doubt that things wouldn't be delivered timely because I was doing, you know, we were all doing editing, but I was out of work for 8 weeks with this concussion. And my cognitive functions, I couldn't look at a computer screen, was just shot. So, as I will never get done telling the story, I listened to Doctor Who Podshock throughout those entire 8 weeks on my iPod while I was laying there in bed, couldn't do much else, as Jesse graded papers and did stuff. Let me just finish. And, okay, go ahead, interject.
I was going to say that Podshock cured his constant state of Mr. Grumpy Face.
Well, thank you, dear wife. I love you, too. And I will never get tired of telling the story that, you know, as I began to heal and listen to Podshock and stuff, and I cite them in my paper and stuff, that... And I sent them feedback about this, that I feel that my cognitive function began to heal because of Doctor Who Podshock. So once I got back into, you know, good health enough to look at the manuscript and stuff, we were pretty much on time. We got all the papers in, and, you know, we put it together. You know, Lori, who's over there, helped me with my MS Word. You know, she signed in the acknowledgments. She helped me with my... bringing me up to speed on my MS Word knowledge, and they can speak of their experience of how, you know what you're asking, Lou.
Well, just to say that we're happy that we played a part in putting the Doctor in Doctor Who Pacha.
Well, you did.
And that we didn't drive you completely insane. That's probably
a medical miracle on its own.
Or that you didn't think that he was stalking you guys.
Maybe. I'm the Doctor Who. Well, you know what? You know... Go ahead, you talk.
We're a married couple, y'all.
Yes, we are.
Oh, you didn't realize that? No. To answer Lou's question first, how was it putting together the book? For a few years now, Anthony and I have done... we did a journal for our Tolkien group, Heron Asterion. The journal was Parman LeLay, so... I was sort of used to doing editing and putting together, compiling essays, but the thing that was so nice about this is I actually got things on time, and because dealing with a more professional level of people who were sending in abstracts, who knew this was something for publication, and sometimes when you're doing a journal for a fan group, there's a different, you know, while I did get some really high caliber stuff, it was a different group of folks, so it was sort of, you know, having to like pull teeth to get things to, you know, out of people. But some of the biggest headaches were just, I don't know, American to British punctuation. And there is a difference.
Spelling.
And spelling,
yeah,
right?
That was a big thing with the editing process, is that, you know, they have a certain way of spelling things, a certain
color, yeah, apologize.
And, you know, labor.
And semicolons are used extensively over there.
And the UK contributors, the call for papers, I posted that all over Doctor Who forums. You know, Doctor Who Podshock, Doctor Who New York, but the UK, Doctor Who Online, the WhoCast, various different places. I know you're talking. I'm just filling it in. Go ahead.
Yeah. As my mother would say, the yak yaron.
And that's how we got UK contributors.
But that was something that I enjoyed doing, and it was also Anthony did the bulk of the editing. He really did put it together, and you know, putting the manuscript together. So that was something. But I did like seeing the papers come in, and when people send abstracts, we accept the abstract with the eye that to make sure that essays don't overlap, that there's no massive conflict. But also, it's interesting. There are several essays in, you know, that I read through the editing process that I may not agree with the author, but I don't have to agree with the author. And that's something that I really do like about this collection. There is such a wide range of topics that sometimes you see other collections and other disciplines, Tolkien being one, you know, there, you name the discipline, where all of the essays kind of conform to one style, right? Yeah. Or one argument, one stance, one way of looking at things. And there are several in here that I was sort of like, no, that didn't happen. No, I don't agree with that. But if they were factually correct and it was a sound argument, I wasn't editing it or looking for it to make sure that it agreed with me. It didn't have to.
Well, real quick, speaking factually, we need to plug our Cloister Bell, which you called him the Cloister Bell.
Yes.
And our Cloister Bell was Mr. Barnaby Edwards of Doctor Who New York.
Who had to leave early tonight.
Yes, who had to leave tonight. Barnaby, unfortunately, is, you know, a little under the weather after a big successful Who York with the Seventh Doctor, Sylvester McCoy. But we acknowledge him in the book, and he was a central key process, part of this process, in which, you know, every essay that came in, including our own, including the editors, he looked at and made sure that every hot Doctor Who fact that was discussed was factually correct. And I think you were in on that process too, Ken. And
I was silently in on it.
Yes, I knew that because he told me you were calling a little bit here and there. But
and even down to having, I remember having a not a bitter, but a back and forth email about a comment that I made in my essay where he said, "Are you sure you want to say that?" Because he knew what was coming. He had gotten, and he's like, "But you can't say, be a little more, don't be so, you know, concrete."
What was the comment?
It was, oh gosh, which one was it? No, it wasn't. It was in
the Shakespeare part, wasn't it?
No, not that one. It was this scene where
there's more than one controversial line.
At the end, oh gosh, I'm trying to make sure that I get the right episode. I think it was at the end of you know, where the master burns on the pyre and you see the red nails coming down clutching
The
Last of the Time Lords. And I said that it was Lucy Saxon's nails. And he's like, "Are you sure? Take that. You don't be so definitive." And I don't remember how I changed it, but I had to put like a qualifying term. So he was, I said, "But it's my interpretation." He said, "But you," I said, "Don't give me any spoilers. I don't want to know." He said, "Well, open it up a little bit so it's not so solid," because he knew what was coming. And I was annoyed when I saw it. I'm like, how could it not be her hand? That was just kind of, because she was the only one with those nails, and it was just like, who is this woman here? We have no clue who she is.
It would have been great if it was the Brigadier.
That would have been fabulous.
Well, Jessica, you wrote about Riversong in the book as well, and obviously you wrote this before the new series, and now we're seeing more of Riversong. Is that difficult to watch now, or?
Actually, the scene where she, you know, her opening scene, when I was writing my essay, according to the points of the Valkyrie, one of the points is flying in the air. And my argument was that flying in the air is also in the TARDIS, because Valkyries were, you know, women who rode on these, you know, steeds through the air. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, through argument, I showed that it was, you know, traveling in the TARDIS, and there are some anti-Valkyries, and even, you know, it depends. Certain characters were actually flying through the air. The Carrionites flew. Well, here's River Song flying through the air. And I had to, in my essay, I had said, well, we know that she arrives on the ship, so she is a space traveler. We know that she's got some history with the Doctor, so I kind of posited that, well, maybe she's in the TARDIS. Well, here she is, flying through the air physically, and then talking and flying the TARDIS. And down to even her costume, the color red, black, and white. white
That's right.
being
you made
the
a point about that in one of our past episodes.
Is sort of it's because it's in my essay linking not just the Valkyrie but talking about goddess traditions being the original Valkyries. Those are the colors: white, black, and red. It's the maiden, mother, and crone. She's wearing all of them, and I was like, did they know this? Or is it just coincidence? It can't be coincidence.
No such thing as coincidence.
And just getting back to your question, Ken, the idea of a first connection. I mean, I don't remember what the first episode, except that when we recently watched Genesis of the Daleks, I had many, many deja vu moments. And I thought, I wonder if this is one of the first episodes that I've ever seen. But something more recent that was a connection, it was more of a personal thing, something that Chris had said earlier, Tolkien had a term called applicability, where mythology and story makes an impact when it is applicable in your own life. And when Donna was, after Runaway Bride, but when Donna was first introduced as more than a fly-by-night character, and there was something that it was really at a rough patch for me personally, but looking at this older companion, it's not just because we're both ginger, but you know, she's living at home with her mom, she's out of work, and it was this personal element that was missing in many of the old classic companions that was, it was really... I mean, I had watched all the other new series, but that was something that really, really drove home for me, and it was a really a personal connection that I'm not sure if I had that personal an investment prior to that. It was, I liked the show, it was great fun, but it didn't kind of tug too much on the heartstrings until that. And she's not a character that everyone likes, or that many people like. But that was something that really made an impact for me, was that.
Well, Rose is still a better Valkyrie, but we won't get to that point. But when I was in graduate school, a friend of mine asked me to knit him a scarf according to a particular pattern with multiple colors. And there had to be certain numbers of rows of said colors. And I asked him, fine, I can knit you the scarf, but... what's with the scarf? And he said, well, there's this television show. And it was playing on our Connecticut public television. And I started watching it in graduate school, and I was immediately hooked. And when you're a graduate student in physics, you don't have a lot of free time. And the things you pick to spend your free time on are very valuable to you. And I found Doctor Who was very satisfying, very intelligent, and riveting, just absolutely riveting. And the fact that it sort of disappeared for many years was, you know, heartbreaking to me. And when it came back on the air, it was sort of almost like reliving childhood in a sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have that little quiver. Is the quality going to be the same? And to see the quality be as good was really gratifying.
It's interesting that you say that, because I have an expression that I use sometimes that says, life is too short to watch crappy movies.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel the same way about television.
Unless they're really bad on purpose and you like them being bad. Yeah.
If it's a giant octopus that eats the Golden Gate Bridge or something.
Yeah.
But the same thing could be said for television, and I would rather watch one show that I know is excellent than... sift through 100 shows that I know are probably not going to make it. And it's interesting that you say that, because I feel the same way. If I'm going to devote some time to a television show, I really want to have some confidence that it's going to be damn good.
Yeah.
But tell us about your personal experience in coming
to
this.
For me, as I'm listening to everyone's stories, I'm trying to remember the first time I ever saw Doctor Who, and I really have no memory of it. I know I had seen bits and pieces of different Tom Baker episodes, and I know there were times that would be airing on PBS, and I'd turn it on because I knew I should like this. It was science fiction. It was this character who seemed cool. I should be liking this. But for me, the really definitive moment when it became my story and a story I just loved was actually I was working on my dissertation, which was on sacrificial death in children's literature, and multiple people kept saying, oh, you're writing about Doctor Who. And I was like, no. And well, you should be. So... I actually turned on the PBS channel one day, and it was advertising that they were going to start airing Doctor Who. It's like, okay, I have to watch this. And I remembered, you know, I was expecting to see Tom Baker running around with curly hair again. And it was the second episode that got me. It was that moment when, I can't remember her name, she was the tree woman. She looks at the Doctor and she says, "Stop wasting time, Time Lord." Because here was this character, I didn't know a whole lot about what was going on.
Jade, yes.
That's right, thank you. I didn't know a whole lot about what was going on with him. You could tell he had lost so much, and there was so much tragedy in his life. But here was someone else who knew who he was, knew what he could do, knew what he was supposed to be, and was able to push him on and say, do it, be what who you are. And that just, that was when I was like, I have to keep watching this show. So, okay.
I think one of the things that we look to heroes for is to bring out the best in ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And throughout Doctor Who's history, no matter what episode you go to, there's somebody that he encounters, whether it's somebody close to him or someone who is a peripheral character, mm-hmm. that either is better or desires to become better because of their experience. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that's essential to heroes as well, in particular in Doctor Who, that mm-hmm. you have someone that you feel you have to bring your A game around this person because they're bringing theirs, or that their expectations are different than mm-hmm. the average person. There's nothing average about them. I wanted to wrap up our...
Well, before you do, I just want to thank the contributors here.
That's why I looked at them.
I want to thank the contributors here because they're donating 2 copies of the book to Podshock supporting subscribers. And if it wasn't for our supporting subscribers, we would not be able to do the show. So I want to thank them. We're giving away the first copy. They signed copies of it right here tonight. So thank you for that. And we're giving the first one away next month on the 25th anniversary of the Gallifreyan Embassy. And after that, thank you. And after that, is the 5th anniversary of Doctor Who Podshock. And so any current subscriber has a chance, it will be randomly chosen, to get receive a free copy of the mythological dimensions of Doctor Who.
Running?
No.
and just one last question, if I could. I know you told us how you got the contributors to the book, but it's lovely. The cover is lovely, illustrated by Andy Lambert. So
love
how did
Andy's
you,
artwork.
How did you discover Andy Lambert?
Facebook. Yeah, there's a, as some folks would know, there's a Doctor Who, Andy's Art Doctor Who is a Facebook group dedicated to this artist who takes a lot of the classic Doctor Who, a lot of the modern Doctor Who, and puts them into great wallpapers. And he was one of 3 artists that were up in the running, and the publisher chose his artwork. This is what he gave. And
here's my collection of it. This is just so that Anthony could be my witness. This is my collection of his artwork on my iPhone, so that I always have a really cool wallpaper with me at any time. And there's hundreds of his.
Yeah, he has hundreds of, and Ken is demonstrating that he has them on his iPhone, and we are bear witness to that.
So friend him on Facebook, and then
friend him on Facebook.
I'm assuming he probably has a regular webpage too.
Well, yeah, you can find him on Facebook, Andy Lambert, but he has Andy's art. Just become a fan of that. Well, Facebook has changed that. You can like Andy's art now, but he was one of 3 artists that was up in the running, and the publisher. It was the publisher's decision, and they chose his cover. And he also did the as a little gift to Barnaby. I arranged. Barnaby likes to regenerate the website with a new banner for every new doctor. So Andy did the new DWY.org banner that is up there now with the doctor, or the 11th doctor, however you wish to put it.
The doctor.
But as Lou pointed out the cover, I just want to state that Ken Deep's great quote is on the back cover and also on the inside first page. Which goes along with Tony Lee, who's written the Doctor Who ongoing Doctor Who comic book.
Yes, by IDW Publishing.
Well, it's a fantastic book. We recommend it to everybody, to our listeners and to the people here. We want to thank everyone at Fiddlesticks and all the contributors to the Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who. It's out now in fine book retailers as well as online. And there's a website as well, isn't there? You can go to kitsunebooks.com. It's on their front page. It's the featured title, and it's Kits... Sure thing, Billy. Or the Emperor, shall I say.
The White Robot.
The White Robot. KITSUNE.com, kitsunebooks.com. Just real quick, as Lewis said, they have copies to give away to supporting subscribers. I was unemployed for 6 months, and I still became a subscriber, so you have no excuse.
Well, it reminds me of the old days when Doctor Who was on public television, and we felt the need to support something that we believed in. And so for the people who are supporting subscribers, and for those who are considering it, it helps us continue to reach out and continue the community. You know, if we were doing a newsletter, people would pay a few dollars to subscribe to the newsletter and have it mailed to their house. And this is really just a 21st century version of how we're delivering this and creating a community, which we have, and here in New York is wonderful, and it's strong, and the support here tonight, obviously, you know, this is what it's all about. We're meeting, and when the recording gear goes off, the discussion's going to continue, as well as a few cocktails, I might add. Which is one of the joys of being an adult Doctor Who fan now, as opposed to doing it when we were 15.
I've heard stories about Gallifrey, and we looked forward to our first time there.
Only a few?
Champions.
Only a few. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please give it up more for the mythological dimensions of Doctor Who. We'll see everybody next time on Doctor Who Podchalk.
Cheers, everyone. Thanks for coming.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, that's going to wrap things up for our live show at Fiddlesticks. I want to thank Anthony S. Burge, Jessica Burke, Christine Larson, and Melody Green, some of the writers and contributors and editors of The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who, the book that we were there for. Remember, we're doing a giveaway. We actually have two copies of the book, signed copies, that were signed at the event by the aforementioned individuals. And both copies will be given away to a randomly chosen Doctor Who Podchalk supporting subscriber once this month and one again next month for our 5th anniversary of Doctor Who Podchalk next month and our 25th anniversary of the Gallifrey Embassy this month. Remember, for a low monthly subscription fee, as a show of support, not only will you be helping us continue and grow the show, but you'll get extra content as well. We just released episode 205 of Doctor Who Podchalk, which was an extra edition. We got more coming up. To become a Doctor Who Podchalk supporting subscriber, simply go to thegallifreyembassy.org or podchalk.net and click on the top banner there, which reads, Become a Podchalk supporting subscriber. And if you're already a Podchalk supporting subscriber, thank you for your continued support and good luck in being chosen for a copy of this book. We also like to thank Fiddlesticks Pub and Grill in Manhattan for allowing us to produce our live show there at the event. They make a great burger, both regular and vegetarian. Well, as far as the regular goes, I'll take the testimonies of Ken and Billy, who attested to that. And as far as I go, the veggie burger was very good. And thanks to Doctor Who Podchalk correspondent Taras Natishan, who photographed the event there for us. Also, big thanks to the aforementioned Billy Davis, a.k.a. the White Robot, who helped us with the event. He was a great asset in setting up all the gear and getting everything working, so thank you again, Billy. Also, our thoughts go to the friends and family of Alexei Kondratiev, who, sadly, we have lost since the recording of this episode. As Ken had said, it was an honor to meet him, and we are very saddened to see the loss of him far too early in his life. Remember, in between Doctor Who Podchalk episodes, you can get your fill of Doctor Who on our website, thegallifreyembassy.org or podchalk.net. There we have lively forums with a great community there, people participating in it, and you could be one of them too. Just simply log in there and join in on the discussions there on Doctor Who. There's news, there's information, there's articles, there's polls, galleries, a whole lot more information about the show, how to send us feedback. So, once again, gallifreyembassy.org or podchalk.net. You can also follow Doctor Who Podchalk on Twitter at twitter.com/podchalk. You can follow Ken on Twitter as well at twitter.com/kendeep. And, of course, you can follow myself at twitter.com/lewistrepani. So, that's it for this time. See you next time on Doctor Who Podchalk. Episode following after this should be our review of Vincent and the Doctor. On behalf of Ken and myself and all the writers, editors, and contributors of The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who, cheers, everyone! You have been listening to Doctor Who Podchalk, presented by the fan-run GallifreyEmbassy.org. Doctor Who is owned and trademarked by the BBC. Doctor Who Podchalk is not affiliated with the BBC in any way. Come back next time for another exciting and informative episode of Doctor Who Podchalk. You can email us at feedback@podchalk.net. Doctor Who Podchalk theme music by Jeff Smith at thejeffsmith.com. This has been a production of Art Trap Productions and is presented to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible in part by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you.
Not quite clear, is it? I can see by your face that you're not certain. You don't understand. I knew you wouldn't. Never mind.